It's not news to you that people have rights in our system of laws. The foundational companion of the U.S. Constitution is the Bill of Rights. But notice, those are individual rights, though often exercised collectively. Do communities have rights, especially where the environment is concerned? Our next guest says yes, and he's going on a road trip around the Northwest to talk about those rights, with an emphasis on community rights as a counter to what he calls the growing corporate state. Thomas Lindsay is the co-founder and executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. He is based in Spokane, and he joins us by phone from there. Thomas, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Yes, thanks for having us on.
Give us a general run of the realm here. When we talk about community rights, what do we mean?
Well, when we talk about community rights, we're talking about the right of a community to actually decide its own future. And that right is often triggered by a corporate project coming in. So an LNG pipeline, for example, or GMOs being used within a community, or water bottling operations or fracking operations, those types of things, that under our current system of law, communities don't have the power to say no to. So it may seem strange to some of your listeners, but in the United States system of law today, if a corporation obtains a permit to put in a particular project from the state or federal government, that our communities are banned from prohibiting those projects from coming into our community. And because many folks have looked at that system of law and said, well, that doesn't seem quite right or quite fair, that corporations somehow have more rights than the people that live in those communities, that a community rights movement has been formed in which people are beginning to reclaim those rights.
So the concept usually is that if the fracking operation or the mine or the water bottling plant, whatever, meets existing codes, that you really don't have a choice to say no. And you're saying you do?
Well, we're saying you do in a different kind of way, which is why the community rights activism is really a different kind of activism. There's two questions that we ask of communities. And the first one is, from the community level up, if you don't have a right to say no in your community to these projects that are going to be harmful to you, then the question is, do we actually have a democracy operating in the United States? And from the 30,000-foot level, if communities don't have the power to say no to these harmful projects coming in, the question is whether we can ever attain economic and environmental sustainability in this system. In essence, we're placed in what we call a box of allowable activism, which is defined by these different doctrines like preemption, in which the state or federal government can tell a community what it can or can't do, and this really controversial subject of corporate constitutional rights, in which corporations have the same rights as persons within the United States, and also, in fact, have rights beyond those personhood rights, which they can use to sue communities, not only to overturn decisions that essentially reject those corporate projects, but also, unbelievably in some instances, can sue the communities for damages. So these communities can be on the receiving end of million-dollar lawsuits for attempting to stop those projects which are deemed harmful to the communities and the people within it.
Does it usually end up in the property rights realm, where I bought this property to use for this purpose and now you're denying me the use of that property?
Yeah, it gets even worse than that in some ways, because the permits that are issued by the state and federal regulatory agencies are deemed to be property under the law as well. So anything that interferes with that permit's operation within that community can be deemed to be violating the corporation's constitutional rights. And so in some ways we live in this upside-down world, this bizarro world, where, you know, we're raised from birth to think that we live in a democratic system. Yet in communities that are faced with these corporate projects, they find themselves with an inability or a lack of legal authority to actually say no to these corporations and to make it stick. And I think that fundamental quagmire that communities find themselves in is beginning to evidence itself by a rising group of people who are saying, we're not going to take this anymore. And in fact, we're going to directly challenge some of these legal doctrines that keep us from saying no in the first place.
Are there test cases to point to, then, where people have attempted to exercise their community rights?
Well, there are. We have 200 communities now across 10 states, including in Oregon. You have active efforts in places like Benton County, Lane County, Josephine County, Coos County, Columbia County, basically a bunch of places where people have come into contact with these corporate projects and are beginning to push back. And they're joining communities across the United States in doing so. The interesting part about these confrontations is that they're basically scripted by the local laws that these communities are passing. So, for example, if a community is working against an LNG pipeline, they're passing ordinances that establish a right to sustainable energy future within their local laws, banning the LNG pipeline at the same time, and then in the same local law or ordinance, actually directly challenging the authority of corporations to have and exercise certain rights within the community. So we tried to be very provocative, you know, this Oregon tour that we're in the middle of right now, to talk about communities revolting against both corporations and the state, because it's impossible for the corporations to do what the corporations do within these communities without the permission and enabling of state and federal government in some cases. And so the fact is people are beginning to come to a realization that it's not just the corporations they run into when the corporation comes into their community. It's actually their own state government and their own structure of law. And I think in Oregon that's been evidenced very clearly over the past couple of years, especially with the passage by the Oregon legislature of the Monsanto Protection Act, which essentially...
Not by that name officially.
Right. Essentially divested communities of any authority to regulate or control GMOs. And that's just one small example of how state governments operate to preempt or divest people within communities from being able to protect themselves against these projects.
We're talking about community rights with Thomas Lindsay. He's the co-founder and executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Let's explore further the concept of community rights and how those square up against corporate rights. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I'm glad you mentioned, I forget the real name of it. It's not called the Monsanto Protection Act officially on the books, but that is a great point, because here you have the state government saying to the county governments across Oregon, except in Jackson County, you can't pass GMO crop bans. And of course, Josephine County did, even though it was not technically allowed to do so. That's one that's going to take a while to work out.
Yes, I think so. And even the Jackson County one is not safe, because even though the legislature carved out a preemption exception for Jackson County, you still have issues with takings of property. So in other words, just because preemption has cleared the bar doesn't mean that corporate rights can't come into question as well in terms of lawsuits for damages for future lost profits or lost profits as a result of the ordinance that's been adopted. And so just to switch the gear slightly, you know, we think of preemption as the state coming in saying, we are going to regulate X, Y, and Z, and that means communities can't. And so they write those preemption clauses into those state laws. But in essence, what those state laws do is actually mandate that use in each community. So when a state passes an Oil and Gas Act, for example, that controls fracking, you know, regulates fracking operations, it's not just saying communities, you can't do X, Y, and Z, so it operates as a negative. It's actually a proactive mandating that says every community must allow fracking within this particular state. And so, in essence, it legalizes in many ways those uses in each of those communities and then proactively forces it into them. And we don't often see it that way, but when the state legislature operates in that capacity, that's the effect, which is mandating that particular use in all communities across the state.
Is the doctrine of community rights, has it been recognized on any judicial level in any court?
No, we seem to have lost historical memory over the past 150 years, and part of that is because there was a fight at the end of the 1800s between a couple of judges and a couple of state Supreme Courts who had much different visions of what municipal government should be in the United States. And so on one side you had a guy named Judge Cooley coming out of the Michigan Supreme Court who said that people within municipal communities should have the right to decide their futures over the next 20, 40, or 60 years, and in addition, that municipal governments are somewhat independent of the state. And then on the other side, you had Judge Dillon, Iowa Supreme Court, who said that municipal governments and people within them are mere creatures of the state, that they're administrative arms of the state, and in fact, in many ways, they're administrative agencies of the state. And the U.S. Supreme Court in the early 1900s put the crown on Judge Dillon rather than Judge Cooley, and adopted Judge Dillon's theory, which at this point says that the relationship between the municipality and the state is one of a parent-child relationship, that the municipal community and the people within it only have the powers that the state chooses to give them. And so this parent-child relationship means that municipalities are wholly captured by the state, And as we know, in most instances, many instances, the state is captured by the corporate interests that are attempting to put specific projects or use particular areas for specific needs. And so in many ways, we're caught in this corporate state where the corporate enabling mechanisms are used by the corporation to wholly suppress any kind of democratic expression within those municipal communities.
Let's take a call. We have Bill in Arcata on the line. We're talking about community rights with Thomas Lindsay from the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Hi, Bill.
Thank you, Jeff. This is a fascinating story of ideas being moved around like counters on a checkerboard. I know of a case from Lake County, Illinois, where the village of Mattawa was forced to annex a piece of land across the road from their city limit and sell it to Granger Electric for their corporate headquarters, even after a court in the same county had ruled that the tail should not be permitted to wag the dog.
Right.
And maybe you can add that to your list of cases.
Sure.
All right. Thanks for that, Bill. Appreciate it.
The parallel to that is brings to mind is something called mandatory pooling of oil and gas operations. Many states currently have compulsory pooling, which means that even if you own the oil and gas underneath your land and decide not to sell it to an oil and gas corporation, if the oil and gas corporation acquires parcels, in other words, the mineral rights around your property, that they can actually force you to divest yourself of those oil and gas resources, even if you have decided not to sell them to the corporation. So there's a lot of compulsory enforcement that takes place around these issues, which in many ways points back to the constitutional structure that we have in the United States, which places certain values over others, and specifically, you know, property and commerce protections over the rights of people, communities, and nature. And in the talks that we're doing on this tour, we talk about how we have a 1780 system of law that protects certain interests over others that isn't working so great today in our time in a contemporary sense, and that we need to see structural changes, not just local ordinances, but also changes to the state and federal constitution to recognize the right of communities to make these types of decisions.
We are talking about community rights with Thomas Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Email here from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. He says, one question I have for your guest, and I'm quite familiar with CELDF, is if CELDF would support a community that tries to establish local rights within an existing legal framework, i.e. find a reverse loophole, so to speak, or does CELDF only support communities that are willing to go to a purist approach? The reason I'm asking is that we in Sunny Valley, Wolfgang writes, are embroiled in a high-stakes battle against a corporate-driven county decision. I believe it involves a gravel pit. We're now in a situation where we could, A, make some headway in terms of establishing some degree of community rights, and, B, generate motivation to then go further toward the more absolute objectives you advocate. We're willing to work with you, says Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. So you're looking for a purist? You're looking for little bits of turf you can begin to expand from?
Well, the one of the problems is that our activism over the past 40 years has been about trying to find those little bits of turf. And unfortunately, after 40 years after the major environmental laws in the United States have been passed, we're in worse shape now than we've ever been. So it's not so much a purist or absolutist type of approach. And in fact, we're a bit player in some ways in all this, because it's the communities that are on the front lines who actually define their own agendas. So, for example, in Oregon or California or Washington State where we work, communities come to us and they say to us, we have this problem and we need assistance. And we actually help them to frame the type of solution that they want. So if the people in a community think that they can actually get to the end goal, their solution, by trying to, you know, pick apart a small unit of the community rights stuff and moving that forward, you know, that's fine with us. It's actually the community that sets that agenda, not us. We just come in to defend the community. And along those lines, you know, the types of services that we provide are helping communities to draft ordinances and local laws, helping them through the initiative process, working with their local governmental officials, and then actually providing legal defense in some cases to actually defend that initiative if it gets sued over later. And I think that's one of the misunderstandings sometimes about the Legal Defense Fund's work, is that it's not a legal strategy, it's actually an organizing strategy. Because many people in the United States, I would say upwards of over 90% at least, believe that we live in a democracy. And some of these fights are actually controlled confrontations to write a new script for community rights that actually shows people that we don't live in a democratic system, and these are the kinds of legal doctrines that are used to subordinate communities to those corporate interests.
So if you get the activists, they'll point in the same direction, though. I mean, are the kinds of changes you're talking about going to be made at the legislative level? We're talking about changing laws rather than trying to get the existing laws changed in court?
Well, when we walk into court, we argue to judges that there's a constitutional right to local community self-governance that needs to be recognized. But in the long term, we don't think that the courts are actually going to be the places where this change is necessarily made. And having said that, I've been surprised over the past couple of years. We had a judge in Western Pennsylvania last year who actually issued a decision saying that corporations were not persons for purposes of the Pennsylvania Constitution, the Bill of Rights of the Pennsylvania Constitution. So, you know, here and there we find judges who are willing to advance this new theory, this new structure of law. But in the end, we think it's going to take textual change to the state constitution, particularly, and to the federal constitution as well. And what's fascinating in Oregon is now these communities across Oregon, you know, operating in 8 different counties at this point, have come together to form the Oregon Community Rights Network, so a state organization, statewide organization. And just 2 weeks ago, they filed the first proposed constitutional amendment to the state constitution with the Attorney General's office, and are now out collecting the 1,000 signatures that they need to then reprocess it back to the state. That state community rights network constitutional amendment would actually protect lawmaking at the municipal level. And so the exciting part is that this movement is starting to move up into those levels.
All right. So is that slated for, what, November of 2016, maybe, if they can get the signatures?
If they can get the signatures, yes. And what it would do is legalize community lawmaking and community rights ordinances.
All right. More to come for sure on the community rights movement. Thomas Lindsay is the co-founder and executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. He's based in Spokane. Thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right. Take care.